nodded eagerly, and I stood up and followed him down the aisle, parting the ice-blue Morimeko curtains that separated the first-class passengers in the nose of this Finnair plane from the larger group lying in repose in business class. They were, it seemed, actually all businessmen, their ties loosened and tossed to the side, their heads flung into profile, eyes shut, computers resting on tray tables or clutched in laps like transitional objects. Then, onward through the next curtain we went, entering the bad breath air of economy, the long, enormous cabin with its pockets of darkness and light, entire families sitting four across, with bags of chips open mouth, rustling, their bodies turning rotisserie style under inadequate squares of blanket, the occasional baby howling and being dandled by an overworked mother singing a Finnish lullaby. The aisle itself was littered as though there had been a windstorm. I stepped on a newspaper, and then on a woman's shoe. In the second-to-last row, Nathaniel's seatmate was asleep, leaning halfway onto the other seat. And because the seat across the aisle was taken, we stood together in the very rear of the plane by the bathroom and the metal drinks cart. "Who's meeting you at Kennedy?" he asked. "My daughters." I'd called Susanna and Alice from the hospital, and their voices, even from so far away, and with the accompaniment of that inevitable overseas hiss, had sounded so forlorn, heartbroken.
"Oh no, Mom,"
Susanna had said, sobbing.
"Oh my God," said Alice. "Dad."
I'd had to leave a message on David's answering machine with the news. It was a miracle to me that he even owned an answering machine. I didn't like telling him this way, but I wanted him to learn it from me, instead of from somewhere else. He hadn't called back yet. I didn't know what his reaction would be, whether he would seem indifferent or glib or even maybe heartbroken, too. I really had no way to predict.
"You won't have to go back to Wethermill alone," Nathaniel was saying now. "That's good."
"I know," I said, imagining the way Alice would come in and commandeer the house, and Susanna would immediately make me a jar of preserved lemons that I would never use and which would become barnacled in the back of the pantry. But at least both daughters would be there at night, sleeping in the rooms they grew up in. Now grown women too big for their childhood beds, they would return, briefly leaving their own families to help their widowed mother find her way, and to help themselves through the bewilderment and clumsy sorrow brought on by the death of a parent. At night, when I found myself unable to sleep, just like Joe, I'd wander the house and pause outside their doors. I'd hear them breathing, and maybe it would calm me down a little. They were still my girls, my children, Joe's and mine, along with everything else we had. The huge flea market of things we'd assembled, gathered up. The astonishing array we'd amassed throughout the years, like any couple does.
"I came to the academic bookstore like I said I would," Nathaniel was telling me softly. "You didn't show, and I was surprised. Then I heard someone talking about Joe Castleman, saying he was dead, and I thought, this can't be. And I ran back to the hotel to ask the concierge if what I'd heard about Mr. Castleman was true. And he said it was. I couldn't believe it. I still can't."
Bone was both heartfelt and unconvincing, I thought. And I was reminded that Joe had never liked him, and that I didn't either. He was insinuating. He was always around. He was like a cat in a bookstore window, letting his tail slowly drape across all the books as he wandered by. Joe's instinct was sound when he decided not to give him anything all those years ago. Now, Bone was waiting to see what I would tell him. I wanted to tell him nothing. What Joe and I had done together was my business and not his. I didn't want to make a gift of this information. I didn't want to let him run with it. It was mine, and I'd do with it what I wanted, but not yet. Joe had just died, and I was now alone. The slap of it stinging, the rest of life waiting. Talent, I knew, didn't just disappear from the earth, didn't fly up into separate particles and evaporate. It had a long half-life.
Maybe I could use it eventually. I could use parts of what I'd seen and done and had with him, making something vicious or beautiful or loving or regretful out of it, and maybe even putting my name on it. "What you were talking about the other day at the Golden Onion," I said to Nathaniel, "about Joe and me, about his writing and how he hadn't seemed talented early on." Bone nodded, and his long hand jerked slightly, as though his impulse, like any journalist, was to reach for his notepad. But he stopped himself and ran his hand through his hair instead. "Yes," he said. "Well, I wanted to say that what you implied isn't true." "It's not?" His voice became suddenly flatter, and he looked hard at me. "No," I said. "It's not. It would be great if it were," I went on. "If I could claim to have written like that." He kept looking at me, shaking his head. "I guess in a way I was sort of playing with you the other day," I said. "Sorry about that." "Oh," he said, slouching down, turning into himself. "I see." Then he shrugged, absorbing the disappointment all at once, starting to move on. For though he hadn't gotten what he'd hoped, he'd actually been there, in Finland, when Castleman died, and that was an extraordinary feat, he imagined. He would flesh out the final scenes for his manuscript based on the words of ancillary figures in the story. Nurses' aides in strange pie-crust crimped hats, frightened maids at the hotel, the young Ibsen character doctor, who may well have provided him with a physical description of Joe in his last moments, the slack mouth, the powerlessness of an old man with a fragile heart. Nathaniel Bone would be all right, I saw. He'd go on and on, rarely at a loss, always being slipped information, treated specially, given access, allowed to roam the world. He didn't really need anything further from me now after all, and yet here we were together. And for some reason I felt I ought to think of something else to say before I went back to my seat. "Look," I told him, "I'll help you with the archives if you want. You can publish a couple of the letters, maybe." "All right, great," he said, but his voice was neutral, and he was probably already thinking about something else, about how odd and shocking this trip had been, or about resetting his watch back to New York time, or about a woman's long, warm back pressed up against his. "And I'll tell you something else," I added. All around us, people rearranged themselves in their seats like dogs in little beds, trying again and again for comfort. Another flight attendant, this one blonde, opaque, unknowable, eased past us in the narrow space, carrying a tangle of headphones down the aisle. The airplane shuddered, bounced slightly, and then lifted itself higher above the world. "Joe was a wonderful writer," I said, "and I will always miss him." This concludes the reading of The Wife, a novel by Meg Wolitzer. Copyright 2003 by Meg Wolitzer. This book was read by Dawn Harvey. This unabridged recording was produced in 2015 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio, Inc. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.